Hello, I'm sitting in Robert's Books, the used English language bookshop in the centre of Riga, and I'm in the company of Will Mahood. Did I say it the right way?
You did not. No, it's Mahood. You should know that, Mike.
All right. I just like to say it wrong every time, just to make sure I can then get the correct pronunciation from yourself. Will is the major domo at Deep Baltic, which is a website that specializes in, well, I'll let Will explain. But we decided to do this podcast, I'm not sure even if it will be a podcast, a sort of bonus cast, a book cast, if you like, because we both happen to have similar interests in literature and history in the Baltic states in general and Latvia in particular. And it seems that we've been reading some of the same very, very obscure books over the course of the last few months. So it's quite interesting to compare notes on that. But first of all, maybe, Will, you could just tell us a bit about Deep Baltic, how long it's been going, what the aim is, and where it's heading.
Deep Baltic has been going now for about a year and a half, I guess. I'd say it's broadly cultural, historical, sometimes we have bits of literature, travel articles, interviews, basically anything that kind of interests me about Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. And the idea, I guess, is because having lived here or spent time here for a few years, I've felt very disappointed by the quality of coverage available about the Baltic countries, which is often quite shallow or quite brief. Like, a lot of the same topics came up a lot, and I thought it would be really nice to have somewhere where we could put longer, more obscure, more niche articles about these places. So I hope we've done that. I'm not sure.
But this is all done on a voluntary basis? Is it a business? Is this just interested, like-minded people coming together to try and create content, or what?
Yeah, it is done on a voluntary basis, or it has been so far. At some point, we hope that we can start taking donations. But I mean, it's hard to imagine that this part of the world, which is, you know, a relatively sparsely populated area, and subjects that are quite, like I said, quite niche. I don't really see this working as a business, and I think to do that we'd have to lose some of the things I like about it, which is that we can have a 6,000 word article about Soviet architecture and we don't need to worry about it making money. So it's been myself and a lot of other people who've been good enough to give up their time and write something. But yeah, so far it has been.
And I know that a few of the things that you've put up there have attracted quite a lot of attention, if we judge it in terms of social media shares and things like that. What have been some of the pieces that have attracted the most attention or the most discussion?
You're right. It's been a bit surprising to me in some ways, because it often hasn't been things that I'd expect. So, for example, things like Jeff Chester's article about Novus, the board game that became the kind of national sport of Latvia and also of Estonia, after coming in a rather kind of complicated way from India originally via Britain.
Yeah, it's a strange sort of mix of backgammon and pool and...
Yeah, it seems to basically be pool that you can play on a ship in rough seas. That did extremely well. That got shared on various websites and other things. For example, interview I did with Edward Lucas, which was quite a different focus on how the Baltic states are going to manage, bearing in mind the rather difficult security situation we're now in with various things that have happened. That got a lot of attention on rather different platforms. An article I wrote myself about the habit that foreigners tend to find absolutely bizarre of adding S onto the end of men's names, at least in the Latvian language, that got a lot of attention.
One that I thought was particularly good was a piece about the well, the lost language of the Leaves, the sort of Finno-Ugric enclave in northeast Latvia, which is, you know, related to Estonian and Finnish, and interesting piece.
Yeah, this was the Lutsis.
The Lutsis, apologies.
Contributed by
the Leaves were another group who lived close by, actually, and I was doing some research and came across them, and I got them confused with the Lutsis.
There are a lot of small groups here and there. It's like 30 or 40 people who have their own language. Yes, that was contributed by Uldis Balordis, who's based in the US, and I just got in contact with because I saw he was doing some interesting research into Latvian and Estonian. That was very interesting, and I think that's the nice thing about Deep Baltic being so far kind of run on goodwill, I suppose, is that we can, I mean, he wrote, I think, 3,000 words, and I thought it was all very interesting, and he had some really nice photos, so I thought, well, just run it in full. I think, whereas if we were operating as a media empire, which is obviously one day the dream, I think that would probably not be realistic, because it would be considered too niche, you know, to have an article about, you know, 40 or 50 people in Latvia who have their own language, basically, and about the history. But actually, the interesting thing is, you know, then you see that, well, there are thousands of people who are interested in this. Maybe they're not concentrated, but yeah. So in a way, surprisingly niche articles can have a wide appeal.
One thing that strikes me about Deep Baltic, which I think is maybe unique, I certainly haven't come across anything similar, and in comparison with, let's say, websites that are written about other countries in Central or Eastern Europe, which are written by people who aren't always themselves natives, is that Deep Baltic, the contributors seem to be immersed in the local culture as much as they can. I mean, they take it seriously. They're not giving this, you know, skats normala. They're not giving the view from the side, commenting on the, I don't know, the cultural mores of the Latvians or the Estonians. Yeah. They actually try and get inside and quite sort of humble about that. And I think maybe that is what gives Deep Baltic its original sort of, I don't know, atmosphere. It seems quite sort of reverent almost to local culture, non-judgmental.
I would hope so. That's interesting that you identify that. I think that's certainly what we're going for, because I think, well, personally, and I think contributors who kind of like the aesthetic of the site, but me personally, I'm not really interested in this sort of, my impressions after a couple of days, because I think the Baltic countries, because they're quite small individually, you know, in terms of population and also broadly in terms of size, do attract this idea that I can go there for 2 days and I can basically understand it.
Yeah, I've done the country.
This is it. Okay, I've got a basic idea of what it is, which of course you'd never have. No one would ever go to France for 2 days and be like, okay, yep. Especially if they knew nothing about France beforehand and they didn't speak any French. And also, you know, because I think in all three countries, the capitals are quite disproportionately large for the size of the country. And you get this idea that I will go to the capital for a couple of days.
Because the capital must necessarily represent the entire country. Yeah. So many of them live there. Whereas actually, all three capitals, that's definitely not the case, is it?
No. I mean, certainly not the case for Riga, and I don't think the case for Tallinn or Vilnius either. I wanted the site to be to be in opposition to this things you get from, you know, the large newspapers in Britain and the US of, you know, someone, like I said, turning up for a couple of days and then writing something about this is what Latvia is or this is what Estonia is. So hopefully that is the case. That's certainly the idea, that we get people who have taken time to understand the culture, have ideally lived here, or are locals themselves.
I think the other interesting aspect which sets it apart is that maybe with the exception of the Edward Lucas interview and maybe a couple of the other interviews, is it's not news as such. I mean, you're not picking on something that you could be termed current affairs necessarily, or if you are, it's just looking at one particular aspect of it, which is maybe informed by history, because a lot of the articles are very historically, you know, informed.
Absolutely. It's not intended to be a news site, because, I mean, there are other outlets out there that do cover Baltic news. I don't think that's what people are coming to the site for. And I think apart from anything else, it's very hard to cover the Baltic states in terms of news, because it's quite a big geographical area and generally resources are very limited. So I'm partly not doing that just because it's very difficult, but also, because it's really what I'm interested in as a reader is kind of often quite long, but you know, detailed accounts of things that allow you to get inside a particular subject. And the nice thing about Deep Baltic is it's actually allowed me to learn a lot about things that maybe I wouldn't have been interested in previously. And, you know, for example, we did an article in the summer about an exhibition in Tallinn about computer digital art from the 90s, which is not something I would ever have thought of as being particularly interesting. But actually, when you learn the background of it, you learn where it's come from, and it's kind of an offshoot of this e-Estonia, the start of this, that people had a lot of time on their hands and started making these, you know, kind of artistic games or images or so on. You see, actually, it's really fascinating. And I'd say the same thing about some of the articles about language and history we've had. And the nice thing is, as well, is it's timeless. Like someone, or more or less, someone can look at an article from 2 years ago and it's still basically relevant, because, yeah, which isn't the case. No one goes back and looks at, you know, classic news articles unless, well,
wow, I remember when that story broke.
Yeah, yeah. Unless they're really era defining, like that's never going to happen. So that's the nice thing about it, I guess.
Another thing that you did was a few months ago here at Robert's Books, actually, you gave a lecture about, the history of cultural connections, I suppose, between the United Kingdom or Britain and this part of the world in the various names that it's been referred to over the years. Bit of an unfair question, but can you give me a potted version of that now in about, you know, 5 minutes, please? Your time starts now.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I mean, that would be very difficult, because I immediately, after promising Edgars, who runs Robert's Books, to do this theme, I said, yeah, I'll talk about the relation of Britain and the Baltics since the start. And then realising that this actually was about 800 years, and I'd agreed to do this in about an hour and a half, did lead to something approaching a nervous breakdown straight away. So I think lecture is a very generous term. I'd say really unstructured ramble would be better. So you want me to condense that further into 5 minutes?
Well, are you going to come to the remarkable conclusion that the links are much more extensive than we previously thought?
Yes, I suppose so. I guess what came across most clearly during my research, and I think you'd probably say the same about the reading you've done for your book, is this sense that Britain appears at lots of odd moments. Mm. It's not really a pivotal player in the region, like obviously Russia or Sweden or Germany or even Poland would be, but it is as a kind of power that's slightly further away. It does kind of turn up often in a defensive role. For example, the fact that you could say the independence of all three Baltic states was secured by Britain, even if it didn't do much at the start. That there were, for example, gunboats in the Daugava during the Latvian War of Independence, and also near to Tallinn in the Estonian War. And I think for that reason, people in the Baltics have generally had quite a positive view of Britain, although I think we may have managed to ruin this in the last 10 or 15 years.
The less said about that, the better.
Yeah, but and that's partly, I think, because we're far enough away that we're not really a threat, and many of the surrounding countries are considered threats. For example, Germany and Russia, who were not traditionally viewed as a threat to Britain as well, to some extent.
But I guess Britain did kind of, well, this part of the world came more to the UK's attention, partly as a result of when Britain was a great maritime power.
Yep.
A lot of supplies were coming, from Baltic ports, so, you know, for building the navy and
yep.
the hemp ropes and the tar and the great trees which were needed for the masts. A lot of them came from here, and I think that's why this gunboat diplomacy is something which definitely comes up a few times. I mean, I only found out a couple of days ago that there were apparently British boats again in the Daugava during the Crimean War. They were,
really?
They were coming
okay.
up. And
it's not something I knew.
Yeah, and this has happened, you know, intermittently every now and again. So maybe it's when there's an economic relationship, then Britain suddenly gets interested. And then when the economic relationship's secured again, it sort of slinks away.
I think that's a bit of a cynical view. I think you might be along the right lines there. I think certainly for the intervention in the early 1920s, I think there were three reasons given. And the first one, I think, is basically to ensure that the Soviets don't get too much control over the Baltic Sea. The second one is to, I think, secure free trade in the Baltic Sea, which is very vague. And the third one is, and we should probably try to ensure these little strange countries that have suddenly appeared, you know, whatever they're doing, we should probably look after them. So I think you can certainly argue the third one was not the priority. But it's certainly, yeah, I think Britain's been very conscious of at least Riga as a trading centre. I mean, there's something I write about in the article I wrote afterwards based on that lecture is Samuel Pepys, for example, the diarist, famously the 17th century, writes repeatedly about hemp rope called Riga rope. Mm. I mean, he mentions this, I think, 7 or 8 times in his diary, specifically mentioning Riga as being the best. But he never mentions Riga in any other connection at all. Yeah. It's only ever that he just this wonderful rope that comes from Riga that he really, really loves. So it does, and that's in the 17th century, you know, there's already clearly a very strong trading connection between Riga and the UK or in England.
And there does also seem to be maybe the other thing which the UK sends to the Baltics in general, and maybe Latvia in particular, is occasional eccentrics. Present company accepted.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, I know we both read a book from the 18th century by a guy called Nathaniel Wraxall, who was a sort of proto-globetrotter who would
the irascible Wraxall.
The irascible Wraxall.
Yeah.
I mean, he does come across as a guy with a lot of attitude and not much patience. But he's for that reason he's quite compulsive reading, and he came through here, which is not a place which, you know, while everyone else is doing the southern tour, going down to Italy and Greece to look at the classical remains, he decides to head in exactly the opposite direction and check out what's going on. And it's very vivid, his descriptions he comes up with, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I think he's an extremely contrary character, and maybe heading north and then deciding that he isn't impressed by anything he finds at all.
Well, he does have a few kind words. I mean, he does occasionally that he'll say the landscape is quite nice because it's so flat you can see, you know, ships from a long way away and things like that. But he certainly doesn't suffer fools gladly.
No. I found it a really interesting book to read, partly because he, as you say, it's a slight exaggeration to say he doesn't like anything. But there are certain things that are just bizarre. Like he describes Riga as... I forget the exact quote, but basically he says, I could not think to fix upon a spot more bereft of any natural beauty or anything like this. And then he describes how he stays there for several weeks for no apparent reason that is given. So he's a very odd character. I think one of these people who enjoys being angry to a certain extent.
Yeah, and seems to enjoy the inconveniences of travel without saying it. I mean, I was recently reading Tobias Smollett's travels in France and Italy. So he headed the other way. And he has exactly the same sort of attitude. Like every tavern that he stays in, he says, this was the worst one so far. Never have I stayed in such a filthy place with such impolite owners, and they charge me, you know, 3 louis d'ors for this. And then the next day he says exactly the same thing. And he's driving through France with a loaded blunderbuss on the back of his coach, which occasionally goes off by mistake, you know, causing mayhem for every town he goes through. And yet, again, you're thinking, well, why are you carry on? Why are you going all the way to Rome if it's so terrible?
Yeah.
I mean, they do have the dual nature, which I think is actually quite attractive, because it's kind of within all of us. And this myth that travelling is all, you know, staying in wonderful spa hotels and getting in touch with our inner self, and, ooh, aren't we learning a lot? And oh, the people, they're all so wise locally here. Yes. Whereas sometimes you do meet them, and, yeah, they're twits, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just like at home.
No. Absolutely, yeah. I think it's certainly a different side of the travel narrative from what we're accustomed to now. And actually, it wasn't just Wraxall. I would say most of the... I think I've read 2 or 3.
There was another guy called William Cox who came through. I don't know if you read...
I don't think I did read that one.
He was like one of these guys who was actually a professional tutor. So he would take, usually... members of the minor gentry or something, and he would kind of guide them as like a male chaperon around where they wanted to go. And he did actually come through here as well, and he was quite different, and he took this sort of forensic approach. This is the other thing that a lot of the travellers of that era, I think, did, was instead of just looking at the view, they would actually go and ask, like, the port master, oh, well, how many ships stayed here this year? What sort of tonnage is going through? Where are all the logs coming from? And they build up, you know,
they'll write a table. Mm. I mean, if you didn't know better, you'd say they were all spies, and probably some of them were. But at the same time, there's this sort of drive to, you know, categorize, to get real information and not sort of vague impressions or ideas that, ooh, it's beautiful. I mean, you're quite... So coming back to Raxall, he says, doesn't say Riga's beautiful, but he does say a lot of things about the trade and about, you know, what's happening there. And I guess that's just as legitimate an interest in a country, and in a way a more compelling interest than it just being sort of pleasant.
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly think you get from the 18th century writers I read less of a sense that they're expecting to enjoy it. Really less of a sense we've got now of travel being a pleasure and something you should enjoy. And I'd say actually Raxall's not the only one who was broadly negative. There was another writer called Leach, I think it's pronounced Leach, rather strange name, but Leach Ritchie, who also, most of his comments about Latvia and Estonia, which is where he mostly travelled through, were quite negative, including being extremely rude about most of the people who, particularly Estonians, who he describes as kind of in semi-grotesque fashion. And yeah, it is. And he complains a lot also about it not being Russian enough. I think he thought, I am in Russia, and therefore, you know, that the architecture and the people and so on should be Russian. And of course, even at that time, it wasn't really.
Well, I think that's quite right. That's quite a theme which probably for maybe 200 years exists, is where people are not quite sure where Russia begins. And some of them kind of give more credit to the, you know, the locals here for having their own country, or like, is Courland a real country, you know, things like that. And is Livonia part of Russia or not? Well, it's part of the empire at certain periods, but maybe it's not. And I think that's something which, I don't know, maybe we're still living in the shadow of that to some extent. A lot of people still think that this is some kind of, you know, Slavic hinterland, whereas it's not. It's got maybe more in common with some of the Germanic or Swedish side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at that time it was, you know, a result of it being part of the Russian Empire, even though it hadn't been for very long. And I think now it's probably a consequence of the number one thing most people would know about the Baltic states if they haven't been here is it was former Soviet, and therefore Soviet is kind of often conflated with Russian. Also probably the geography. You know, if you look at the map, they're all basically the same size. They're next to each other. We kind of assume they must be all the same.
And there's not a big range of mountains dividing one from the other.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah. But there is, I mean, and there's a certain strain of irritation sometimes in, I mean, Arthur Ransome, the kind of 1920s, well, mostly famous writing children's books, but he is someone I spoke about later in the lecture. And at one point, he...
Rekundra's last cruise, first cruise.
Yeah, yeah. So he took a series of voyages through the Estonian islands and then down the Daugava and the Lielupe. And at one point, he describes being on a remote Estonian island, and with kind of a lot of irritation, he said, and the people there refused to speak to me in Russian or in German. And you think, like, well, if it's a remote Estonian island in, you know, the late 19th or early 20th century, it's entirely possible these people just didn't speak Russian or German. And I think you still come across this attitude sometimes that people are just being kind of, you know, cussed by speaking their languages, which you wouldn't say, you know, again, about France. Like, you know, I go there and everyone speaks to me in French, even though they possibly know a bit
you
of
might
English.
Say they don't speak English, rather than they refuse to speak English, because
exactly.
This implies implicit knowledge is there, but they're unwilling to share it.
I mean, obviously, the, you know, it's entirely possible that they were refusing to speak Russian to him for nationalistic reasons, but
or
it seems
he was
a bit
annoying.
Strange.
Maybe he was just a bit of a twit.
Entirely possible. I mean, he's a very strange man, but so that's also kind of a theme that runs through it. I guess that it's a dilemma, this way of, you know, stating quite firmly we're not Russia without saying and therefore Russia is bad, which is a trap I think people sometimes fall into. But no, I mean, I would say the Baltic states are different from Russia in almost every sense. There's no way they could be considered part of the Russian world, as somewhere like Ukraine could to an extent, simply because, you know, they're not Slavic, they're not Orthodox, even that the language isn't written with the Cyrillic alphabet. I don't agree with Ukraine being considered, you know, basically the same as Russia either, but it's clearly easier for Russia to make that argument, even though it's incorrect. I don't think even Putin really considers the Baltics to be part of the Russian world.
And mentioning Ukraine, you're off there again. I know you travel there quite frequently. I mean, are there any plans to do a Ukrainian Deep Baltic, or would that be something for someone else?
I think that would be something for someone else, yeah. I think what I like about Deep Baltic as a concept is there is a kind of when I first started the site, I wrote basically, I think the second article was kind of almost a mission statement, which is just called "Why This Is Deep Baltic," and I kind of assumed, which has happened, people have thought I'm a kind of passionate advocate of the Baltic identity, which I'm not at all. I think you could argue there's no Baltic identity, or only a very loose one. But I said what I like about the region, and why I think it's very interesting to look at as one unit almost, is that it's so varied. You have, you know, a country like Estonia, which is historically Lutheran, is very close ties to Scandinavia, and then you've got Lithuania, which is Catholic and, you know, has this history of being a great Central European country, and is just clearly, I mean, you just need to have an Estonian and a Lithuanian together, and usually, not to generalize too much, but you can see there are enormous cultural and behavioral differences. And I said, to me, that's a really good thing. You know, that the variety is a great thing. And the fact that they're all relatively small, you can't really include them in another geographical unit without them, you know, being kind of left out. Mm. Like, attempts to treat Estonia as part of Scandinavia, I mean, that's up to Estonians if they want to be considered Nordic. But if you're doing it in a media environment, Estonia is always going to be the one that's left out because it's much smaller. Mm. And the same with Lithuania, if it's treated as part of Central Europe, it's significantly smaller. So there is a kind of pragmatic reason to treat it as a unit. For somewhere like Ukraine, I don't know, it strikes me that it's too big and too well known in a way to find these kind of interesting, obscure stories. Because I think lots of the things that I like about, well, I think that readers seem to like as well, is that it's finding things that are really not known, often even to people in this country, which is much more possible in a small country.
Well, yeah, it is nice that, in a way, you can have the pleasure of saying to people, this exists, you know, without assuming that they knew it already. I mean, that's actually quite a fresh thing to be able to do. You can introduce people to something rather than having to work on their preconceived ideas of what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, it's been a real pleasure being able to do that, and, you know, being able to kind of introduce some really excellent pieces of writing, I think, from contributors. And yeah, I mean, I hope it's something we can continue to do. And I think, yeah, we don't really build on the preconceptions readers have, because I think if they're outside the region, any preconceptions tend to be wrong, quite skewed, basically, as we've been discussing. So it's sort of, you almost have a blank slate to work with many readers. And we do have a lot of people who, well, I can see from the statistics, at least half of the readers are not in the region. So and a lot are from countries where I assume there's relatively little knowledge of this part of the world.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to me. Our half hour is up.
It's been a pleasure.
Good luck with Deep Baltic in the future. There are some really, really good articles on there, and I would encourage everyone to visit the site and check some of them out. I'll include links at the bottom of the feature, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again in the future, Will.
Yeah, hope so. Thanks very much, Mike.